The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 30th of October 2020 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's programme...
It's not just about the group that tried to kidnap Governor Whitmer. It's about the connections between that group, the Proud Boys, Adam Waffen and the Base, the Boogaloo Boys. There are many of these groups on the scene now.
How much have America's white nationalists been emboldened by 4 years of President Donald Trump? And would a change of administration change that? Also ahead, we'll find out why Japan's new prime minister is failing to make much impression on Japan's voters. We'll analyse the results of New Zealand's twin referendums and...
Hello, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and today I'll be talking about His House, the new Netflix horror film that everybody's talking about, and why horror is one of the most profitable genres ever as well.
That's all coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. And welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. The current US presidential election campaign, which draws to a merciful conclusion 4 days from now, has been such a circus that events which would have defined other contests have been swiftly forgotten. Among those was the thwarting earlier this month of an apparent plot by far-right self-styled militiamen to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, and the subsequent discovery of links between those alleged conspirators and other white supremacist groups. This is a cohort which has been repeatedly nodded and winked at from the highest pulpit in the land these last 4 years. What happens in the next four, whatever happens on Tuesday? Well, earlier I spoke to Kathleen Ballou, Assistant Professor of US History at the University of Chicago and author of Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement and Paramilitary America. I began by asking Kathleen how the white supremacist movement has changed between the 1980s and now.
There's two differences in what's happening in the 1980s and forward. One is that the violence this movement is interested in carrying out is explicitly anti-state. They want to overthrow the federal government. So this is one of the reasons that I think white nationalist as a term can be confusing. The nation and white nationalism after 1983 is not the United States. It is the Aryan nation. And they're imagining a fundamental overthrow of the country and all of its democratic practices. So the other thing that's different is that this movement is bringing together a lot of different people. In every way but race, it is an incredibly diverse social movement. We're talking about a whole bunch of different subsections of white supremacist thinking. So this is the first time in the 1980s that we see a unification between Klansmen, neo-Nazis, skinheads, radical tax resistors, posse comitatus members, and then in the early 1990s, we start to see militia members in these groups as well. Now, all of that is emblematic of a movement that has taken a page from earlier American history, right? So it borrows from the opportunism of earlier Klan mobilizations, but it's very different in its deadly intent and in the number of people it's able to bring together in this new set of sort of violent belief systems.
If you consider its current numbers and its current firepower, how is it possible to quantify how dangerous these movements are? I mean, obviously, we have seen in recent weeks the apparent thwarting of a plot to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan. But is that, and it's a depressing thought, but is that likely a straw in the wind? Will there be more of that sort of thing?
Not only will there be more, but that story is already proving to be more than it looked at first glance. There were reports today that members of the base, which is an underground paramilitary white power group, have been arrested in connection to that plot. So already we're seeing cross-group organization, and we're seeing how this is working in a network, much the way it did in the 1980s. So one of the most important things that people can do to understand what this is and to combat it is simply to connect these stories with one another. It's very easy, especially in a news cycle when people feel so buffeted with information at all times and sort of feel under attack by their own news feeds, I think. It's very difficult to do the work of paying attention, but it's absolutely critical here because it's not just about the group that tried to kidnap Governor Whitmer. It's about the connections between that group, the Proud Boys, Adam Waffen and the base, the Boogaloo Boys. There are many of these groups on the scene now. Now, to your question about numbers, this is a very difficult one. I'm not sure we even have an accurate headcount for the earlier movement, and that's where we have the most consistent set of archival materials. So as a historian, I'm very reluctant to make specific claims about the movement right now because I don't have my sources together yet, and I won't have them for another 10 or 20 years. But what we know from reading the history and from reading the news, so in other words, what the context that history gives us can show us is that we have every reason to be concerned about further activity and escalating violence. This is a movement that is intent on mass casualty attacks, that has used not just voter intimidation, but all kinds of other violent means over the years, and that has been organizing in this way quite effectively for decades, if not generations. This is not a new problem, and it's not something that will go away quickly. And the other thing is that this is a movement that is organized around cell-style action, much like a group in radical Islamist terror would work, except that this group has been doing that since 1983. They're very, very good at it. Because they use cell-style organization, there's not a great correlation between rising size of group membership lists and rising capacity for violent action. Because if you're trying to carry out an act of cell-style terror, you're not interested in 2,000 people who are going to come out on Saturday and march down Main Street. You're interested in 6 people who are willing to detonate a bomb. So the difference is sometimes what we see is a shrinking of membership before an intense surge in violence. I'm very concerned that that's where we are now. And I think, you know, the people who do have archival information for the present day moment are saying the same thing. So I'm hearing this from people in the FBI, people at Department of Homeland Security who have access to surveillance documents. I'm hearing this from people at the Southern Poverty Law Center and other watchdog groups who spend their time monitoring white power and militia activity online. And I'm also hearing this from people who work in de-radicalization, trying to help people out of the movement. Everyone is sounding the alarm bell right now. Everyone is running up the red flag. And I think, you know, you don't have to listen to me. I'm just a historian. But I think everyone is calling everyone they can think of to sort of try to get people to pay attention to this very grave situation.
I mean, has there been an acceleration in the momentum of these groups because of, if obviously for radically different reasons, the last two presidents? You had the fact of a black president of the United States, which clearly a number of people had a significant problem with, and he is followed by a president who is, to put it charitably, equivocal in his condemnation of these groups.
Yes, absolutely. And we're seeing a very clear relationship between political rhetoric and extremist action.
I mean, is that toothpaste you think can be put back in the tube?
Not at all. That's a good metaphor for it. I usually say we can't unring the bell, but yes, exactly the problem, right? Because, you know, if you take something like the president's remarks in the first debate about calling the Proud Boys to, quote, stand back and stand by, even if you take the most generous interpretation of his remarks and say, okay, perhaps he was fed that group name and he doesn't know who they are. Perhaps he meant to tell them to stand down. Even if we take all of that as given, I think that there is a very real problem, first in the fact that it's not just the Proud Boys who heard that as a paramilitary call to readiness. There are many other underground groups like the base, like the guys in Michigan who heard that call as the call to action. And there's another problem of, even in the case of activists who right now support the president, there's no indication that he has the power to call these people off once he has ignited a wave of violence. As I said, this is a movement that has been expressly anti-government for many, many years. And this is a strange thing about the United States, that it has, since the Vietnam War, been very possible to hold a position in the United States of being anti-government and pro-president or pro-military or pro-cop at the same time. I mean, we see Ronald Reagan making statements about how the government is the problem, not the solution, while he is the head of the government. So that sort of gymnastics act of balancing that sense of fracture is not a problem for people here. So there is a way that you can be pro-Trump right now and still be dedicated to a violent overthrow of the state down the road or at some present moment. And another note of caution is just the last time that this movement became very deadly, setting off the string of events that led to the Oklahoma City bombing and, you know, the most horrific mass casualty attack for the United States between Pearl Harbor and 9/11. The last time that happened was not under a leftist administration. It was under Reagan. And it was because activists in this movement saw Reagan's perceived moderation as a sign that political means could never deliver the kind of change that they wanted. Even Reagan was not offering what they wanted, which was, you know, reestablishment of Jim Crow segregation or reinstatement of slavery or establishment of a white homeland. Things like this were much too radical for mainstream politics. So there's a real chance that even Trump will hit a line where it's too extreme for him. I mean, even Trump is not talking about reestablishing slavery. And at that point, I think there might be a wave of dissatisfied people, if he's reelected, who are interested in mass casualty attacks.
Just finally then, is there an aspect of this which is not just or perhaps beyond politics and beyond even race? It strikes me, just looking at the way in which the members of these movements present themselves, that there's this strange cartoonish idea of masculinity in play.
You know, it is a very masculine movement, but it turns out that both in the earlier movement and today, women are incredibly important to this activism. You don't always see that in the public facing part of what they're doing. But in the period of my study, there's a whole bunch of women who are sort of forming the social network that holds these people together and really makes possible violent action. And they're doing everything from publishing their own newspapers to running their own auxiliary groups to driving getaway cars and disguising people when they're on the lam. And even as they're doing all that, they are saying things like, I'm not an activist, I'm not political, I would never seek a leadership role, because, you know, within this worldview, that's what good womanhood looks like. But however you cut it, women are incredibly important here. And we would be foolish to think that those deep social interactions aren't part of what is sustaining this groundswell.
And I guess, you know, just finally, and feel free if you like to refuse to gaze into a crystal ball, but how do you see this playing out in the next, well, in the next few weeks, say, if the polls are correct and Donald Trump does lose office on Tuesday?
Well, I think everyone in the United States is approaching all polls with a degree of caution from now on for immediate historical reasons. My concern here is that there's no mental picture that I can paint. There's no series of events that I can see that would make someone at this point, with this set of social pressures, with this worldview, simply put down the weapons and go home and say, oh, well, we've lost this round. It's time to go do some democratic change somewhere else. So my concern is that if Biden is elected, I think that these activists will not only be frustrated and rally, but will look for mass casualty opportunities. If Trump is elected, I think that one end game has to do with them feeling dissatisfied and turning to mass casualty attacks en route to overthrowing the government again, as they've been doing for quite a long time. Another route would be a continuation of sort of this wink and a nod / outright calling to arms line of rhetoric. I mean, there's a way that groups like this in other contexts have become strike forces and death squads for authoritarian regimes. And there we can look to Southern America and Central America for many examples of how that's happened. All three of these are threats to Americans and to our democracy. So I think it is a very bleak time for people who pay attention to this particular part of the American political life.
That was Kathleen Belew speaking to me earlier. Kathleen's book, Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement and Paramilitary America, is published by Belknap. You're listening to The Briefing. Here is Monocle's Yolin Goffin with the day's other headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. French officials say a man who killed three people in Nice yesterday had only recently arrived in Europe. The Tunisian suspect, who is believed to have travelled on a migrant boat to Italy, was shot by police following the attack and is in a critical condition in hospital. The UK's Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab has said that a second national lockdown in England is not inevitable. He added that a localised approach could work if everyone stuck to the rules for their area. It comes as European nations grapple with a rise in coronavirus cases. Some students in Thailand have been boycotting their graduation ceremonies to show their dissatisfaction with the country's monarchy. Thailand's king traditionally hands out degrees to graduates, but many students have become disillusioned with the monarchy's influence in Thai society. And Portugal's plan for a high-speed train route that connects its two major cities of Lisbon and Porto is finally back on track. It's part of a €43 billion plan to modernize the country's rail infrastructure. And you can find out more about it by heading to monocle.com/minute. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Yolene. Japan's new Prime Minister, Yoshihide Suga, had a tough act to follow. Shinzo Abe, who stepped down for health reasons last month, had served for nearly a decade and was charismatic and dynamic. Suga, having now served 6 weeks, has given little indication thus far of being either of those things, and it is costing him in opinion polls. Approval of the government has slumped 11% since he took over, though Suga would be entitled to retort that this still leaves him with 52% in favour, which a great many national leaders would swap for. Well, I'm joined from Tokyo by our bureau chief there and Asia editor Fiona Wilson. Fiona, thanks for joining us. First of all, the poor bloke's only been in the building for 6 weeks. He'd barely have enough time to figure out how to get an outside line. Are Japan's voters always this impatient?
Yeah, I think I enjoyed your introduction there. Yeah, I mean, I think it is pretty tough, isn't it? As you say, you know, he was following a prime minister, the longest serving prime minister in Japanese history. So it was very difficult. I mean, I think, you know, as you said, he's not noticeably charismatic. He's quite grumpy. He's been in the diet speaking over the last few days. He gets quite short with people. He doesn't have this easy charm. And yeah, the polls have been a bit hard on him in the last couple of weeks. I mean, the polls are quite specific about different things. Some things he's done, they particularly don't like. He got involved in this spat with the Science Council of Japan. Very odd battle he chose to fight there. It's an advisory body of academics, and he vetoed six of their suggestions, six academics he didn't want on that council. And it's become a kind of distraction, a bit of an unnecessary talking point. And it led people to think, well, why not? Why can't we have them? And he couldn't really explain. Overall, I think, you know, he had his big policy speech on Monday, which went down fairly well. I mean, it was very broad ranging and you know, it's been picked apart slightly over in the diet in the last few days. I think he's had a fairly soft ride. I don't think the opposition has been that tough on him. They certainly grilled him on the economy, the environment. Some of his proposals, like making Japan carbon neutral by 2050, they were looking for some more specifics. So, you know, it's difficult because he's now, you know, having to say, I'm not just Abe, take two. I've got something else to offer. And I think that's when the criticism begins, really.
Well, I think he's pretty much established that he's not Shinzo Abe too, though not perhaps in the way he would have preferred to. Has he just been slow in laying out a positive vision of what he wants to do as prime minister?
I think, you know, he's honestly slightly hamstrung by what Shinzo Abe's been doing. I mean, you know, obviously the economy is in you know, it's in dire shape, as most economies are at the moment. But because of Shinzo Abe's absolutely monster stimulus package, you know, it's $2 trillion. It doesn't leave Suga with a lot of room. What else is he going to do? I mean, there is talk now of an extra $95 billion being pumped into the economy. But, it, you know, really, he's looking at the real detail. You know, it's more about the structural reform. How does he open up the jobs market? How do you get more women into the market? These aren't quick solutions. I think that, you know, the thing they're really looking for here is, how is China doing? How is China emerging from this year? It's very important. Japan's economy is export-led. It's really important export to look up. And actually, the latest results are fairly positive. Productivity is also up. So, you know, it's not all bad news. You know, car production's up. Machinery production is up. So there are some sort of glimmers of light. And I think once the economy starts to move, it will be easier for Suga. But at the moment, you know, you've got a very anxious population. And, you know, remember, salaries have not been going up here for a long time. So there isn't a lot of spare cash for people to be spending money, which also will stimulate the economy. So it's a very difficult time for the Japanese economy. And that is hurting Suga already.
Fiona Wilson in our Tokyo Bureau, thanks as always for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing. We'll be right back after this.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. The global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Today, the company is working on breakthrough treatments that push the boundaries of human understanding in biology, data science, and engineering to develop and deliver therapies that help people live longer and healthier lives around the world. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You're listening to The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. Now, it's fair to say that the New Zealand general election of 2 weeks ago excited more international attention than any previous New Zealand general election. A low bar, but still. However, as many citizens of democracies around the world gazed wistfully southwards at a reminder that electing basically competent and decent people is still a live possibility, largely overlooked was two referendums held the same day, one on legalising euthanasia, the other on legalising cannabis. The results of those two are now in, and joining me to discuss them is the New Zealand political journalist and regular Monocle 24 contributor, Laura Walters. Laura, welcome back to The Briefing. These referendums went one for two, so tell us first of all which one won and which one lost.
Yeah, so we have in the preliminary results for the two referendums, or referenda, if you're that way inclined. And so the voluntary euthanasia did pass. So New Zealand voters voted in favour of legalising voluntary euthanasia. So that got across the line with a 65.2% yes vote. But the legalisation of recreational cannabis was voted down by the New Zealand electorate by a very slim margin. So 53.1% of Kiwis voted no, and 46.1% voted yes.
We'll talk about those two individual results shortly, but I wanted to ask about the general tone of the debate around both of them. Did New Zealand manage to have a sensible conversation about both of those things, or did they both, as I suspect they would have right now in most Western democracies, turn into shrieking partisan culture war bun fights?
It could have been better. I mean, it could have also been worse. So it was divided. You know, it didn't get too nasty, but there was quite a lot of division in both of these debates. And we did see misinformation campaigns, and we did see a lot of lobbying from both sides, but especially from the more conservative side. There was a lot of money and a lot of lobbying, especially very close to the election and those two referendums. Of course, these issues have been debated for a really long time, and misinformation in this space is nothing new. And we did see that in New Zealand, but it wasn't an all-out culture war.
But around the euthanasia discussion in particular, and that is the referendum, as you were saying, which does appear to have passed, those campaigning against it, is religion still a major factor in Kiwi public life?
Yeah, so we've actually seen, you know, more and more people saying through census data that they're not religious at all. But you're right, religious groups were really pushing that that no vote. So they were really campaigning hard against voluntary euthanasia in New Zealand, especially the Catholic Church. So we saw a lot of campaigns coming out from the Catholic Church in the lead up to the referendum. But it's also important to note with the euthanasia referendum that this is a discussion that's been had over a very long period of time. So a lot of that campaigning, especially the campaigning from the Catholic Church, we actually saw happen over the past couple of years. There was less of it in the immediate lead up to the referendum, say in the past month or so. But yes, a very strong campaign against euthanasia from the Catholic Church.
And on the cannabis one, the Prime Minister, the recently returned Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, said she voted yes in both referendums, and which is interesting in the case of the cannabis one, because it is traditionally the forces of law and order which take a stand against the liberalisation of drug laws. In New Zealand in particular, was it possible to say which way actual law enforcement went on the idea of legalising cannabis?
So there was a lot of discussion around that, and especially from the likes of the Police Association, for example, where they said, well, you know, if there is this legalisation, it's not only going to impact our work as police, but also, you know, our officers who might be using cannabis and then coming into work, and of course might be using firearms in the job and things like that. So there was a lot of discussion from law enforcement, but it was more from a perspective of what works, what does the science say, how will we figure this out if cannabis does become legalized, more so than them taking a specific stance one way or the other. But what we did see from the National Party, which is the main opposition party, which is centre-right, was that from a law and order perspective, they said, as well as a health perspective, but from a law and order perspective, they said that, you know, they were against the legalisation of recreational cannabis. So more of that opposition came from political parties than it did from, you know, the likes of police.
Laura Walters, thanks for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. You are listening to The Briefing with me, Andrew Mullett. Now, tomorrow is, of course, Halloween, and a Halloween which many of us are going to spend refusing to open the door to people dressed as COVID-19 spores. Monocle's culture correspondent, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, is here with an idea for something we can be watching as we wait for the infernal knocking to subside. Fernando, this is a film, and it is, because it's Halloween, this is not a light romantic comedy, is it?
No, not at all, in fact. To be honest, Andrew, for me, horror films are for every single day of the year. I am one of those massive fans of the genre, and I think the genre is proving to be very creative these days. And this film that I'm going to recommend, called His House, I think you might like it.
Unusually for us, Fernando, we are going to have a discussion of culture in which we do come at it from opposite angles. I mean, who knows how this is going to play out? But just as you are as an enthusiast of horror movies, I am very much a non-enthusiast of horror movies. So sell this house to me. Why would I want to watch this?
Well, because it's a different type of horror. It's a different type of haunted house. The story of the film is two asylum seekers that come here to the UK in a very bleak estate in Essex. And the house is haunted. The problem is, they can't really leave the house, because if they leave, they will be deported back to the country where they escaped from terrible violence. And even when they're outside walking the streets, it's almost, they feel as much fear as when they are inside the house. So it's a different type of story, because you can't just like, oh, it's haunted, let me pack my bags and get out of here. You literally can't. It's a very clever film by this...
Well, that right there at least does head off one of my perpetual irritations with the haunted house genre. It's just like...
Just get out.
Exactly. Just go. What are you doing? There are other houses.
But you, in that sense, you can't. And I think directors have been very creative, and perhaps they're trying to attract people like you.
And they don't do the thing at any point of running to hide in a cellar with only one exit?
No, not that I can remember. And I can't reveal too many secrets as well. But I had the pleasure as well to speak with Remy Wiekes. And it's remarkable. That's his first feature film as well. And it's been quite buzzy. All the critics are giving 5 stars. And, you know, as a film critic here as well, I'll give you my 5 stars. But, I mean, we actually have a clip of my interview with
him. Let's have it.
Congratulations. You're being released as asylum seekers, not as citizens, not yet. You will be sent to a home of our choosing, You must not move from this address.
What really drew me to this story was the concept that as asylum seekers, when you come into the UK and you get granted asylum, you have to follow really, really tough, really cruel rules, like not being able to just leave the house, not being able to work, being given a very small amount of money to live off. And so you're forced to be, you're almost forced to live with inside the haunted house, even if you wanted to leave, you're kind of stuck there.
Because I got to be honest, I am an immigrant. I come here, I moved to the UK. Watching the film, of course, I was scared of all sorts of things that happened in that house. But it's quite scary when they were outside, you know, dealing with kind of this real world. You know, everything feels quite kind of bleak and daunting as well. Almost as bad as what happened in the house, in my opinion, as well. I don't know if you have any thoughts on this.
Yeah, I think what I enjoyed by making this film, and also a lot of this film was based on research. So we did a lot of research on asylum seekers in this country and people's first-hand experiences. And I think a feeling you get a lot of the time is a sense of disorientation, the not really knowing or understanding how you are, well, I guess your place in society. You can move through it and feel somewhat secure, but then you can also be very threatened by the place you're in. And so that kind of constant disorientation is very much a part of the experience of an asylum seeker.
Tell us about the cast as well. I mean, again, both very talented actors. I mean, Sopa Diritsu and Wumi Mosaku as well. They did an excellent job. How was to deal with them and choose them as, you know, the characters for the role?
We were very lucky to have been able to audition them at the same time in the same day. Wumi lives in LA and she was in town briefly. So we were able to get in, and Shope, a producer, saw him a few days before performing on stage and told us that we had to get him in. And so we were able to get them both in at the same time. And when we saw them perform together, it was the chemistry was instant, and it was really clear that these guys were the perfect team for the film.
That was you speaking to Remy Weeks earlier, the director of His House. We're still doing the thing where you try to sell it to the not necessarily horror genre aficionado, i.e. me. It still sounds to me like this is going to be a horror film. It's just going to make me feel, you know, anxious and unhappy.
Oh, yes, of course. But to be honest, I mean, the world is already making us so anxious. So I think we're kind of getting used to it, Andrew.
Kind of my point.
Yes, I mean, but you know, we'd like to be true. Then one of the secrets of the success for horror, I mean, even at the time that we could go to the cinema, actually, because it's quite a communal experience. So people still actually go. It's like a blockbuster film. You know, they like to have this feeling of fear together with other people. So come to my house one day, we watch a horror film together.
As soon as that ever becomes possible again, or in fact, maybe you could do a meta-horror film about people gathering when they're not supposed to be during a time of... This isn't really going anywhere a one-line pitch, is it?
I have another recommendation for
go
you.
On.
There's a film called, where people are talking on Zoom. And then there's a demon that starts killing everyone while they're talking on Zoom. That's a very 2020 film. It's called The Host.
See, people getting murdered while talking on Zoom actually sounds like something of a blessed relief as opposed to a horror film at this point. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you. That is all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Rhys James and Yolin Goffan. Our studio manager was Steph Chungu. The Briefing is back on Monday. I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening.